Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be taking a look at using gluten-free flours to make yeasted bread on the show today. And we have an expert baker back with us, Paul Novak. He is the author of A Baker's Dozen of Daily Breads and More. He's taught baking classes for Orange Tree and for MATC. And he's here to help you with your bread making skills. So, do you constantly have the same problem when baking gluten-free bread? Maybe you have other baking questions. I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Paul Novak, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry.
We have, before we start about baking gluten-free, we had a listener email us and ask if she can get a digital version of the record that came out with your cookbook, which is a great record, by the way. Is it available?
It's not available digitally. It's because George Winston owns the rights to the music. I still have copies of the sound sheet to sell. But, yeah, so far it's not available digitally. We can work on that in the future, but right now not.
Okay. Well, something to think about down the road. Is it true that I know this, the length of the song is the amount of time you should knead your bread?
When I commissioned George to do it, yes, I made it about 8.5 minutes, which is about what it takes me to do a typical loaf. But then I had him do three parts, meaning you work at a medium tempo, and then it gets harder to work it in the middle, slower, and then it gets speeds up at the end. So that was the idea, that you could listen to it and go through the three tempos, in a sense, of the song and your kneading.
You ought to re-release that book. Do you have any plans for that?
Well, nowadays, I would probably do it on a a DVD with a disc, but even that's going out of, it's harder to monetize streaming. So yes, it's a bit of a quandary for me to do how I would do the third edition.
Gluten-free baking has become more and more popular. When did you first start experimenting with it?
To be honest, all I've really done is create that one recipe that I think you have reference to. It's a record label that my son has done recordings with, and they have a cookbook, and I submitted the gluten-free recipe. The reason I was interested is I did a yeasted gluten-free recipe. Most of them are you're going to use baking powder, baking soda, as a leavening agent. So that was sort of a challenge to do, and it works, but I will always choose, gluten because I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah, well, what happens when you don't have gluten in baking bread?
Well, then you've got to add all these binders to it, because gluten is sort of a, it stretches, it's a protein, creates the structure of the bread, the crumb. So then there are all these additives like xanthan gum and guar gum in tiny amounts, but then fairly big amounts of tapioca flour or cornstarch or potato starch. What's another one? Sweet rice flour as the binder. But I chose to also use egg, so it's not vegan.
Yeah.
But I also put potato in it as a binder. And even using applesauce instead of oil, the pectin is another binder. So I thought it worked as a yeasted non-gluten bread, but it's a lot of work, and those ingredients are not cheap. You don't use a lot of them, but and a lot of them will use rice flour, which I think is just too bland. So one of my favorite non-gluten flours is sorghum flour. Partly because it's grown in Wisconsin. It's got a good taste. So that's one of the things I would always put in a gluten-free bread, is sorghum flour.
Yeah, I like sorghum anyway. So that's appealing to me. Kip, yeah. Kip in Dodgeville has something for us. Let's go there. Kip, hi.
Yeah, so this is the time of year we do a lot of baking in our house, and my partner is got celiac, so we ended up using gluten-free flour, trying to convert old family recipes. We use Namaste Perfect Flour Blend for pretty much everything, and it works really well, except when we're trying to make our Christmas bread, which is a cardamom raisin currant bread. It bakes up really nice, and then it collapses. So the flavors are all there. Everything's great. But then, you know, after it starts to cool, it just gets really dense. We've tried baking it in smaller portions, doing smaller loaves. We just tried this weekend making it more in like a small, almost muffin size. They worked really well. They collapsed. We put them in the microwave, and they puff up.
How long from after you make the dough, how quickly do you bake it then?
Well, we let it rise a little bit. We set it next to the wood stove. It gets, you know, kind of rises up a little. We cook it up to a higher temperature than a regular dough. We go to about 210. We try cooking it at a lower temperature for longer, all those different things. We bake it until we get it up to about 210 degrees, and then, you know, after a couple of minutes of cooling, it just starts to settle itself down.
What's the leavening agent? Is it the baking powder?
It's a yeasted.
Oh, it is a yeast one. Okay, so then the yeast is working, and then the yeast then somehow, well, the yeast will die in the oven, and then you'll get oven spring, but then it dies. So I'm wondering why you get so much carbon dioxide production, and then it escapes and the bread collapses.
Yeah.
And I think partly one of the problems with non-gluten bread. You don't have the structure to hold together, and all of a sudden you get a gap, and you lose heat, and you lose moisture, and you lose carbon dioxide.
Yeah,
that's interesting. I will have to admit I don't have an answer for you, but what baking is experimenting. You've already tried doing different temperatures, so maybe you want to let it rise more or let it rise less before you put it in the oven. I'm not an expert on gluten-free breads, but I do congratulate you for doing a yeasted gluten-free bread.
Yeah, the rise business, that might be worth experimenting with for sure, Kip. You could have a couple of loaves. You could let one rise longer while you were baking the other one.
Is there a lot of sugar or egg or?
Yeah, it's a good old fashioned Norwegian recipe. So it's egg, flour, butter, and sugar.
Yeah. So you're creating a real challenge for yourself to take a traditional recipe, make it gluten free. And get it to work, you know, in all the different ways, structure, texture, taste, moisture. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, maybe somebody else has tried that too, Kip, and we'll join in. Here's our number, by the way. It's 800-642-1234. If you've had that same experience, I'd love to hear what you have to say about it. So give us a call or shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org.
Or the next time I'm on the air, call in and tell us what you've discovered.
Yes.
I mean, that's how we all learn
Yeah, absolutely.
Nobody knows it all, yes.
Thank you, Kip, and good luck. Robin in Portage will go to you. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering, I have a bread-making machine. I've only made regular bread. I have not made gluten-free bread in it. And I'm wondering if the bread-making machine can be cured. I understand you can't make gluten-free bread in a machine that is made regular bread. But do you know if it can be cured so that it can be used for gluten-free bread?
Well, one way that people use a bread-making machine sometimes is just for all the kneading work. And then when that's done, they take it out and they bake it in their own oven.
So that's
a possibility, meaning you don't go through the whole timing of a yeasted bread in the machine. You just do some of the initial mixing in it, and you don't do the baking in it. I mean, just throwing that out as a possibility.
Yeah, I think that's not a bad idea. Give that a shot, Robin. Thank you for calling.
But the other thing is, how old is your machine?
Oh, yeah.
Meaning a 20-year-old machine had fewer options than a brand new one and different companies. So, yeah, I'm not savvy. I don't really use mine much anymore, and it just sits there, but it's old.
Yeah.
The newer ones can do whole wheat. You know, the newer ones have a stronger motor. And maybe they have more buttons to push. Maybe does someone have a gluten-free button? I don't know.
Okay. Robin, thank you. Appreciate it. Barbara in Montello. Hi.
Hi. I make a gluten-free bread, and I've been told it's really good. I use buckwheat flour and millet flour and some rice flour. And mainly I use one-third millet, one-third buckwheat, one-third oat flour. And then I use guar gum. And I use golden flax for instead of eggs. So it's a vegan one as well.
Okay.
And I use yeast. I mix it up, and then I let it rise for 40 minutes. And then I put it in the oven and shrinks a little bit, but not too bad. Oh, it's got some cinnamon in it. Cinnamon goes really good with buckwheat.
And one thing I'll comment on is that you can now get oat products that are gluten-free, meaning technically gluten. There's a bit of gluten in oats. So look at the labeling, and it'll be cost more, but there's gluten-free oats, and then there's the oats that they don't, pay as much attention to. But also flax people don't like the word mucilaginous, meaning it's also a binder, especially if you grind it up. So that helps the structure of any bread. I use it in my, in all my breads too. So that's a very good idea.
Barbara, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Hopeful, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking about baking bread, and we've zeroed in a bit on gluten-free breads and gluten-free yeasted breads with our guest, Paul Novak, author of A Baker's Dozen of Daily Breads and More. Great to have him back. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. I hope you will. Keith in Fitchburg, what's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Larry. The previous caller asking about curing a bread-making machine.
Yeah.
My college roommate was diagnosed as a celiac patient more than 20 years ago. There is no acceptable level of the protein that actually is the problem for patients with celiac disease. So you cannot actually cure in the means of taking a bread machine that was used for gluten bread and make it gluten-free bread.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that call. I appreciate it, Keith. Well, Jamie in Algoma, we'll go to you.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been on a lectin-free diet, which would also include gluten, since Memorial Day weekend, and found a cookbook by Claudia Kariki. I hope I'm not mispronouncing her last name, Living Well Without Lectins. And there is a bread recipe in here that is to die for. It makes these little rolls. They're about the size of a golf ball, crusty on the outside and gooey and soft on the inside. Five ingredients. There's cassava flour, turmeric powder, sea salt, sweet potato puree, and I just use baby food sweet potatoes, and olive oil. That's it. They're easy, and they are delicious.
Hmm. What do you think, Paul? Sounds good to me.
Using cassava flour, that's essentially tapioca. So that's a traditional food, a traditional binder. I don't know how much protein it has, meaning I'm not sure how nutritional it is. But making rolls is also a good idea because then you're unlikely to have the issue with the collapsing, meaning you have more crust, smaller interior. So, rolls is definitely a way to go with gluten-free foods. And having more specialized needs gets really complicated for people, meaning some people it's the carbohydrates. Some people can handle spelt, but then they develop an intolerance to it. So I've heard many stories about the specifics of what a person can deal with and what they can't deal with, and it might change over time. So I sound very pessimistic here. I'm sorry.
And Jamie, what was the name of that cookbook again?
The name of the cookbook is The Living Well Without Lectins Cookbook. And lectins is L-E-C-T-I-N-S.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Appreciate the call. A lot of people might like to get a hold of that.
Yeah. Can I recommend a cookbook also?
You bet.
Clara's Kitchen. When she wrote this in 2009, she was 94 years old. It's a lot of Depression-era cooking tips from a woman who's got all these videos on YouTube. And it's a lot about frugality. And that's, to me, it's somewhat fascinating to learn about the past. I'll just say my mother was born about the same time as this woman. And so people at that time remember lard sandwiches.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I had bread, I had butter sandwiches. And I realized recently that this was just a upscale version of the lard sandwich. Thinking about this woman and my mother who lived through the Spanish flu, World War I, the Depression, and World War II, you sort of realize when the 50s came, it was nice to have a calm decade.
Except for the Korean War.
Yes, right. A lot of interesting things in it, like bay leaf tea, et cetera. So,
Claire's Kitchen.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to remind people of is the flip side of frugality is that certain ingredients do get old. So, for example, baking powder and baking soda might only last a couple of years. So your 10-year-old, or I should say my 10-year-old baking powder and baking soda, are not as potent. So there are things we need to replace a little more often than we are used to. So this is the problem with frugality. Sometimes you get in trouble for being too frugal.
And we have a link to that book on our program notes now. So go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry and look to today's date under our program notes. Jill's put that in our program notes. So we got a link to that book. And we also have a link there to the recipe that you put together for us as well, Paul, on gluten-free bread. So there you go, a couple of things there. Jessica emailed, talking about allergies. She has food allergies to eggs and dairy along with gluten intolerance. Oh, my goodness.
Yikes.
She has tried many types of alternatives like vegan eggs, but have failed with most baking attempts. Are there any replacements? What are some replacements for ingredients like eggs?
I will have to say that when I've watched baking shows that eliminate dairy or eliminate eggs or eliminate gluten, you see professional, bakers still struggle. So I don't have an option for eggs because eggs do so many different things. meaning people have gotten around gluten, people can get around dairy. But honestly, that's, you know, that's a hard one. And a lot of festive breads, you know, have huge amount of eggs, you know.
Yeah.
A challah bread, for example, or, you know, yeah, or pancakes.
Pancakes.
Yes.
Oh, man. Sorry, Jessica.
I'm not doing too well today.
Yeah.
My answers, yes.
Yeah. Well, tell you what, we've got another. Oh, I'm trying to find something here, and I'm not getting it. I'll have to while I'm fiddling around here with my. Let's go to another caller, and I've just screwed up my board here a little bit, so I can't tell. We have a caller from Madison. And that caller wants to know about, why am I having this trouble? It's Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Larry, you got me. Am I on?
You're on. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to share about a former student of mine named Rachel Aquila Alexander, who's a phenomenal dietitian. She's only 25, but she's put together an amazing website and podcast and recipes. It's called Roots and Rosemary. And I saw her navigate her way through all kinds of eating, issues with dietary restrictions. And she worked in community kitchens, and she's developed this excellent resource for folks, and it's available online. And you can just look her up. It's Rachel Alexander at Roots and Rosemary, and phenomenal, healthy, organic, egg-free, gluten-free, nightshade-free options for cooking.
And the first word in that was roots, did you say?
Yeah, roots, like R-O-O-T-S, Roots and Rosemary.
Okay.
And if people are looking for an excellent resource from a local person, Rachel is just brilliant.
And her last name again is?
It was Utke, U-T-K-E, but I think it's Alexander. I think that's the site name on her website now, Rachel Alexander.
Okay. Thank you, Elizabeth. Appreciate it. Let's go to Paul in Toma. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Larry. Hey, so I started sourdough, made my own starter, and unfortunately I did not give it some attention over the last, 4 months, and it's got a little science experiment with some black stuff on top. Can I still use that starter, or do I got to start over?
You can try to save it. What you could do is take off all the obvious contamination, or I should say the molds and the fungus and the whatever's grown on top. If it, you know, meaning blue, green, yellow, black, you don't want. Having a gray liquid on top is okay because it's, you know, you've actually created alcohol. So there's a small layer of alcohol. So you could skim that off, you know, feed it and see what happens. And you might have to filter off some of that, too. So maybe you can save it.
I'd be more inclined to start over myself.
Yeah, reading the Claire's Kitchen, one of her things is, if she would say if something was totally rotten, she'd throw it out. But if it was only partly rotten, you know, like, a squash, she'd cut off what was not good and use the rest.
Yeah.
So, everybody has different feelings about frugality.
Yep. Mark emailed to ask if you have tried using mung bean protein in baking. Mung bean. He's allergic to wheat and eggs and recently found a product called Just Egg that's made from mung bean protein. It comes in a liquid form and cooks exactly like regular eggs and tastes the same to him. He has used it to make pumpkin pies and other recipes to replace egg, and says it works really well.
The liquid that comes with chickpeas is often used as a substitute for egg whites, meaning it'll actually froth up. but I'm not sure how you substitute for egg yolks. So, yeah, so using lentil flour is common in Indian cooking. Any of the beans are used as a protein, but also the liquid in chickpea cans is used. There's a name for it. I can't think of it. As a partial substitute for eggs.
Mm. Yeah.
So the world of possibilities is immense.
And so that, and his mention was he uses just egg, and it's among bean protein uses in his baking. So, Mark, thanks for that. A listener called in, couldn't stay online, and wondered if you can make lefse gluten-free.
It's worth a try. It's just a dry pancake.
Yeah.
I remember years ago when I was on your show, Larry, we talked about lefse, and it's essentially a potato pancake. So you could use, you know, a potato. It's usually potato cream done in a dry skillet. And I'm sure you could put in a different flour and make it gluten-free. But I remember talking, and somebody called in and said, oh, that's the other way to make lefse. We make our lefse without potatoes, meaning it was all flour.
Oh.
It was a different kind of pancake. So that's, I didn't even know that there were two different kinds of lefse. You know, and then somebody else called in and said, oh, in Norway, we don't care about how thin the lefse is. That's only for Norwegian Americans. So it's sort of like, whoa, okay.
Oh, man. Paul Novak, our guest, talking about baking with him. We've zeroed in a bit on gluten-free, but we're taking others as well. You can join us at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org.
Well, Larry, can I mention a little bit about labeling? I mean, I realize I'm making everything more complicated today, but an example is durum flour versus semolina flour. They are technically two different things, but you can't be sure when they're labeled, meaning semolina is only, the bran is taken off of the durum and it's ground up, and it's pretty coarse, but durum flour could be the whole grain ground up, and it tends to be tan. But when you get durum or semolina, you can't actually be sure, you know, which one it is. and I wanted to tell people, Italian 00 flour, that's, 00 means it's finely ground. That doesn't say anything about the protein content. So it depends what kind of soft wheat was used for, you know, Italian 00 flour. Meaning you can't always be sure. White lily is a southern all-purpose flour as it's labeled, but it's really way closer to a pastry flour because they use it a lot down south for biscuits. So to me, it's, you know, it's an easy way to get white pastry flour, even though the label will say all-purpose. You can't always believe what you read, I guess I'm saying.
Well, let's go to Tekla in Beaver Dam, who has something for us. Hi, Tekla.
Hi. I was wondering if you have any tips for how to get a chewy chocolate chip cookie rather than a cakier chocolate chip cookie.
Oh, wow. This is, yeah, I was asked about this recently. There's a number of factors. The pan, do you do it on a totally flat pan, or do you use what people think of as a cookie sheet, but it's actually a jelly roll pan that has an edge on it? So that affects the heating, whether it's totally flat or whether it has sides to it. Then clearly it's temperature and how long you do it. But then it's a big deal is what's the fat in it, meaning old-fashioned recipes might have called for Crisco, which I think is evil, but that's just me. But others will use, you know, some kind of vegetable shortening, whatever. And about other people will want to use butter. And that clearly is a difference what oil you use.
So what gets you a chewy chocolate chip cookie?
Well, you wouldn't bake it as far, you know, as high, as long, or as hot. Whereas the crispy one, you would do it at a higher temperature or for a longer time.
Okay.
Oh, and beware of the pans that have the air layer between the two sheets of metal. You will not get a good crisp bottom on those.
Oh.
But maybe that would work if somebody wanted a chewier cookie, you know, with less crust. I'm just throwing out possibilities here. If the person would ever figure out how to, you know, make this recipe chewy and that recipe crispy, they'd make a fortune. Meaning, I think this is one of the more complicated things in the world, you know, the decision. And which, you know, and there's obviously things in between crusty and chewy.
No.
Another one would be the flour. Some people are going to use pastry flour. You wouldn't want to use bread flour, but what all purpose do you use? King Arthur has got a higher protein content than gold medal, for example. So, you know, I mean, I'm getting into really subtle differences here, but my recommendation would be to try one variable at a time. You know, change the temperature or the time or the pan or the flour or the fat. I mean, right there, we got five big variables.
Yeah.
I'm not giving out very good answers today, apparently.
Well, technically, try some of those one at a time and see what happens and let me know. And send me some. Thank you very much. Oh, man. Let's go to Louis in Ocado. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, happy holidays, fellas. My question is actually twofold. One is, if you're going to start making for the first time a sourdough, is there a time of year that you can get a better organic yeast filtering in if you set it outside or something? And second of all, is there any interesting flours that you can use for a sourdough, like a rye flour or something?
I'll answer your second question first. Yes, I maintain a sourdough in my refrigerator at all times, but I also have a sour rye culture going also at the same time. So I started that years ago with actually the dregs of beer making. So one possibility is, let's just say you've got a sourdough culture going, you divide it up and start a new culture, and you gradually add in rye flour and turn that into a rye culture. There are different yeasts and bacteria that will flourish in one compared to the other. They'll have different characteristics. Rye is a little more prone to contamination until you get it going. But the first question, if you're going to start a sourdough culture with wild yeasts and bacteria from your house, that's one thing. I'm not sure I would go outside with it, but that's another approach. Other people get the wild yeast and bacteria off of grapes or apples. It's a trickier way to do it. There used to be a gold medal, Gold Rush. It was a sourdough starter. You actually just rehydrated it, and eventually it would give you a sourdough culture. And realize, eventually you'll have a Wisconsin culture. You know, I got mine probably 40 years ago. Somebody brought it back from San Francisco. But it's now Wisconsin culture.
Yeah.
Time of year, you'll have more. The air is moister in the summer. It's warmer. you'll get more growth, but you'll also get the, you know, yellow, green, or blue that you don't want. And clearly temperature is a big deal for bread baking. You know, how long your sourdough sits out overnight for the bread the next day depends on your house temperature. So, yeah, more wild yeast and bacteria in the summer, but also more of the other stuff in the air in the summer. If that makes any sense, I would probably, you know, try it, you know, maybe in the fall. Things are not so cold, but maybe less, you know, less pollen in the air too, less things floating around. It's just an experiment.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Louis. Appreciate it. Wayne and Sobieski, your turn. Hi.
Hello. Interesting, that last caller from O'Connell. I called about the previous caller on the sourdough starter or that he had going that had mold or whatever on it. I agree with you that you probably should skim it a little bit. My family had a bakery when I was a kid, and the only thing I'm expert on is washing bread pans, just so you know. But I find that keeping it going, you get much better sour taste. It keeps, you know, and you feel like the bread gets much airier and you get a lot more action out of it. I've had ours for years and years and years also, and we keep it in the fridge and it goes pretty good. One thing, if you're going to start a starter, like the gentleman said from O'Connell, if you want to start one now, it'd be pretty, you can do it. It works out pretty well. And I usually, if I have to start one for someone or show them how, I usually do it like with a pineapple juice, water, and a rye start or rye flour. And I usually put it up high because that's usually the warmest spot in my house. You need it somewhere between like 72 to 78 degrees. And it works pretty well. I have mine, I'm looking at it right now. It's sitting on a top shelf in the kitchen. And I just fed it a little while ago. And I don't feed it all the time. I'll feed it and use it for bread. I'll put it back in the fridge then tomorrow. And I'm going to make a loaf tomorrow, put it back in the fridge, and then I'll feed it again when I need more starter made. But I usually do it about once a week, and it goes real well. Taking care of it and watching what you're doing with cleaning utensils will help it last a long time.
Well, Wayne, thank you so much.
Yeah, and I will second that it, you've got to clean your container periodically. You know, I will sterilize the jars and put it in new jars and keep it going. And I only do mine every 2 weeks because I'm doing sour rye in between. But doing it every week is probably preferable. You can probably get away with, you know, doing it after a month or 2 months, but then you're risking, you know, it going bad. I do have to say, if you've got a sourdough starter, you are committed to caring for this colony for the rest of your life. So, and this is another reason to give it away sometimes, so you've got a backup, you know.
This is a good idea. On that note, Paul, we are out of time. Thank you so much. It flew by. Thanks so much, and I'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much, Paul.
Okay. Look forward to seeing you sometime, Larry.
Yeah, you as well. Yeah. Paul Novak, author of A Baker's Dozen of Daily Breads and More. Always fun to have him on, and he'll be back, and we'll do this again. But we're going to turn our attention to travel next. You know, travel requirements change a lot, and Carrie Mulliken from Bon Voyage World Travel is back to talk with us. That next. I'm Larry Mueller.